This episode of In the Thick is brought to you by 1-800-Flowers.
All the anger that is justifying this violence is based on we're victims, therefore our violence is justified. What they're selling is victimhood, both sides.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm joined by Farrah Stockman, reporter for the New York Times. Welcome back, Farrah.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And also joining us from New York is Mike German, a former FBI agent who worked as an undercover agent among white supremacists. Welcome back to you too, Mike.
Thanks for having me again.
So let's just dive into the news. We're going to start by turning to France. A lot of people were scared that this wave of ethnic nationalism that we've seen with Donald Trump with Brexit might spread to France.
Centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron appearing with his wife, celebrating a decisive victory over the far right's Marine Le Pen, winning by a landslide margin of about 30 points.
Le Pen did get over 30% of the vote. So, Mike, you know, are you more worried because of the fact that there's this 30% out there in France that did vote for Le Pen, or is this a sigh of relief?
I think there is a sigh of relief. You know, it's obviously better than the alternative, but I think it demonstrates again that this ethnic nationalism, if you want to put it that way, is still a prevalent part of the political discourse in Europe and the United States.
What about you, Farrah? Are you feeling, how are you feeling about what happened in France?
Well, my friends in France are pretty relieved. But I think it's also important to note that Macron is still, he's an investment banker. He's has no experience in politics. He's never held elective office. So it's still not like he's status quo.
And Marine Le Pen was a very known commodity there, much more so than Trump's politics were really known here, right? I mean, this creation of the alt-right in the United States was something that confused a lot of people throughout the election and even still today. So I think that this is still going to be a powerful force that we're going to have to deal with and bring out into the light in order to show what it's really about.
All right. Also this week, the House passed a revised version of the American Health Care Act, which puts millions of people at risk of losing their health insurance. But Idaho Republican Raul Labrador, who was born in Puerto Rico, said this.
Nobody dies because they don't have access to health care.
Nobody dies because they don't have access to health care.
Yeah, I don't think you're right on that one, Raul Labrador. And writing in the Boston Globe this week, Professor Michael Jeffries said that the repeal of Obamacare comes from a place of, quote, racial resentment that was directed towards Obama and fueled the rise of Trump. So, Farrah, what do you make of this line of argument?
I can see where he's coming from. You know, a lot of this is about block granting this health care to the states. And if you look at how the welfare system did that, which was done under Clinton, like some states did great and other states like Louisiana did pretty poorly. And like the larger the black population in your state, sort of the worst they did.
Are we jumping the gun here? I mean, this was only passed by the House. It's got an uphill battle in the Senate, which is very unclear. And I'm wondering, kind of watching the Republicans fall into line on supporting this without even many of them having read the bill. You know, are we jumping the gun, Mike?
Certainly the celebration at the White House was jumping the gun. And I think it reflects their lack of victories in Congress since the inauguration. I think one of the things sort of to focus on here is the way racial conflict is used to sort of divide the working class. I mean, this is an old tactic that's been around for a long time, and that this is really an economic struggle. And if you look at some of the other broader definitions of fascism, one of the things that you have to understand is it's the marriage of government power with corporate power, right? That's sort of the Mussolini version of corporate syndicalism that I think this hyper-capitalism is really reflecting. And the use of the racial conflict is what assists the government and the corporate forces joining together.
I had a brilliant point, but you just made an even more brilliant point.
Yeah, I want to say, this is while Mike was talking, Farrah was like, I'm about to make a point. And then Mike stepped talking, and then she's like, I'm going to back away.
No, that was wisdom right there. I was just going to say that this bill hasn't even been scored yet. So we don't even know. We haven't even seen.
Yeah, at the time of this recording, we don't know what's going to happen.
What it's going to cost, who it's going to affect. And people voted on it before it had even been scored by the budget office. So that's I don't know if that's a first, but that's pretty crazy.
So last week, there were May Day protests across the country, and some turned violent.
More flashbangs going off here right now in downtown Portland.
Farrah, you recently wrote an article for the New York Times about violent protests across the country in the wake of Trump's inauguration. So what do you make of the recent protests and the arrests, and specifically the ones in Portland where there were arrests and violence going on?
Well, so I've been following anarchists and people who call themselves Antifa for a long time.
What is Antifa?
Antifa means anti-fascist. And they are, so as the alt-right has morphed and risen in recent times, there's a sort of countervailing force that they see themselves as a violent opposition to the alt-right. And so they basically show up to Nazi rallies and beat them up, or they believe in violently confronting people who they believe are advocating violence. Mm-hmm. But I do want to say that some of these protests, like I've interviewed dozens of these people, and I've read their magazines, and they have some really fascinating and eloquent things online. But they don't consider themselves violent. If they attack a bank or a Starbucks, they say that property destruction is not violence. And so I just wanted to make that. We might disagree, but that would be their argument.
Because you're destroying corporatism.
Yes. Then they would say that they're, smashing the window of a bank or smashing the window. And a lot of this happened around the time of the inauguration. They destroyed a limousine, and they were saying, look, this is to shine a light on something far more destructive. And we're not actually hurting human beings.
I think a lot of people would be like, OK, you're hurting a car. We get it.
In front of the Washington Post.
Right.
Because the thing about the car, before you continue, Maria, is like, part of the car thing is like, it happened in front of the Washington Post. So you had all these journalists like taking a picture and be like,
the dude did a rap on top of the limousine as they were destroying it.
So Mike, what up with law enforcement? How are they seeing this action?
Law enforcement tends to view certainly violence, but even protests from the left as much more dangerous than protests from the right. You look at the way that police reacted to the Occupy movement, which was almost entirely nonviolent. And, one of the things we have to keep in mind is civil disobedience has long been a cherished part of how we create social change in the United States. So, where the line is of what we would call violence, certainly breaking a window isn't the same as shooting someone. And so, if you look at the far right and the kind of violence that comes from that extremist element, there's no comparison on the left. Yet the police reaction is often not just much more extreme, but also much more confrontational, where you'll have police in riot gear actually confronting the protesters and initiating the violence.
A couple of weeks ago, violence erupted at a far-left protest in Berkeley, and the police waited a long time here in this case before intervening. So here's a place where the police were not actively jumping in, although it was a protest from the left.
In Berkeley, California, this video was just moments ago, a fight breaking out among the crowd there.
A reporter from Mother Jones, Shane Bauer, asked a cop, why weren't they intervening during what was basically, some people were calling like a riot on the campus? And the cop said, I'm not at liberty to discuss my tactics. Mike, why do you think that police in this case might have been reluctant to intervene towards a protest coming from the left?
So I would argue this was not a protest coming from the left. This was actually a pro-Trump protest that many neo-Nazi and far-right groups had vowed to come to create problem. So both sides, the rhetoric was, we've been victims in previous protests. There was an earlier protest in Berkeley in March, and then one at Bolsa Chica State Beach in Southern California, where Trump supporters infiltrated by extremist far-right groups, neo-Nazi groups and the like, confronted protesters, and there was violence on both sides. And what I'm concerned about with these three protests in California is the police seemed, rather than taking that aggressive, confrontational stance that they take in left protests, they actually let that violence take place and stood back. And that, I think, is extremely troubling, because it tends to sanction the state sanctioning that kind of street violence is the sort of things you see in budding totalitarian states.
I will just say that there is some soul searching to be done on the left about what to do about these young and angry folks, because there tends to be, a lot of people don't want to believe that they are out there and that they believe looting is justified or that violence is justified. But you gotta listen to what they say, and they really do, and they make some of them make it very eloquent justifications for it. So in preparation for the show, I went on the online publication called itsgoingdown.org, which is like an anarchist.
It's called itsgoingdown.org?
Yes. And I've been following it for months.
Okay.
Not all the anarchists, some anarchists are pacifists, so I don't want to put them all in the same basket, but there is this black bloc group that believes in more, sort of kinetic forms of protest. Mm-hmm. And some of them really, and this guy, he writes, I am a member of the poorest generation since those who came of age during the Great Depression. Our future has already been looted. It's time to loot back. And I mean, these are the people that started, that were participating in Occupy. They're the people that did anti-WTO. I mean, some of them, they just have an intellectual structure behind them, and we haven't been listening to them, but they are sort of the angry and unwanted stepchild of the left. And we have to come to terms with that and say, are they going to make the rest of protesters look bad? Because there are a lot of protesters out there that are peacefully protesting, and yet these guys can show up and ruin your peaceful protest.
It's like a buzzkill. Dude, stop destroying property.
Do you understand the optics of this?
Right.
And some of them were attacking Trump supporters in San Jose. And so, it's just, I wish that they didn't have that bad eye. You can wish them away, but they're there. And I think they're going to, their appeal is growing as the alt-right grows.
So I was actually in the middle of downtown Los Angeles getting ready to go interview the mayor when the May Day protests were going on in L.A. And there was a group, by the way, a diverse group of pro-Trump supporters on one corner, and on the other side, actually in the middle of the street, was a pro-immigrant rights May Day rally. And the police were actually just kind of keeping things at bay, but the emotions were clearly high. I happened to be, just because of where I ended up, on the side of people who were supporting the immigrants. And then I just ended up, and by the way, I was like super well-dressed, so it was kind of hilarious because I was wearing heels and a dress and all this kind of stuff. And I ended up in the middle of a group of all, I think, young men and women of color wearing black, covering their faces.
Right.
And they were getting really angry. You could just tell. Now, I paint that scene, actually, Mike, because I don't think that immediately takes me to what you just dropped there a second ago, which left us all like, what?
Yeah.
How does that relate to creating budding totalitarian states?
So there's the what they're selling is victimhood, both sides. All the anger that is justifying this violence is based on victimhood. So we're victims, therefore our violence is responsive violence, defensive violence, and therefore justified. So when both sides now are coming to these protests, like the ones we saw in Berkeley, looking for a fight, justifying their own violence, and the police letting it happen, that builds concern among the peaceful protesters, certainly, who are caught in the middle of this conflict, but for the community as well, who will then demand a greater police response. And this cycle of violence, because, you know, one of the things that I would warn, I totally agree with what Farah said about listening to the concerns these groups are bringing to the table. But, you know, violence is incredibly counterproductive to their goals. And you know, what we, and I think back to the 1979 Greensboro massacre, where there was similar sort of anti-Klan activity taking place from a far left group that had a death to the Klan rally, and the Klan showed up with guns and five protesters were killed. So, you know, the violence can escalate very quickly, not just putting people in harm's way, but justifying a much stronger police response, not just to far right protest or far left protest, but to all protest. And then that suppressive effect is what then empowers the state to act.
American peaceful protesters protesting against the Klan were gunned down by who exactly?
By Klansmen.
By Klansmen in Greensboro, North Carolina,
and
in the year 1979.
Right.
So what Mike is saying just begins to feel, again, just a little bit scary, because we have been here before.
I just want to go back to the super deep point that Mike made earlier, was about how this could be seen as an economic struggle of people who have just been disappointed by the economic system as
right.
it stands right now, and it's benefiting a smaller and smaller group of people, right? And yet, instead of uniting and doing something about it, they're fighting among each other, right? You're seeing poor whites fighting blacks, fighting Latinos, instead of fighting the tiny group of people that are really the beneficiaries of hyper-capitalism, hyper-globalization, the economic system we have right now. So that's just the backdrop, right? We don't know that private equity guy who has taken our factory or taken our jobs. We just know the person across the street who is, you know, we're jealous of, or we have access to these people that are right in our face, right? But the shadowy world of finance that is really benefiting from the system that has been set up just gets off scot-free.
What about the victimhood point?
I covered a Trump rally in San Jose that turned violent. And a lot of people on the left wanted to believe that it was the Trump supporters that mm-hmm. created the violence there. And in fact, that rally of Trump supporters had like a third of the people who were Trump supporters were Latino. A third of them were Asian. It was incredibly diverse. And they were being attacked as they walked out. The minorities in that Trump rally were being attacked by Antifa and by protesters for being a black person supporting Trump,
Whoa.
For being a Hispanic supporting Trump, for being Asian supporting Trump.
Right.
And I interviewed some of these people who are now the police department of San Jose is being sued by the Republican Party in California for failing to protect the Trump supporters. And so the police kind of tried to keep these two groups apart, but they didn't succeed. And in some cases were, you know, they were shown, like, you know, watching some of these harassments take place. But the protesters would grab a Trump hat off the head of an elderly Hispanic woman or an elderly Asian
wow.
woman. And I would call it ignorance, because those young protesters who are grabbing the Trump hats off the heads of those people did not have any idea that those Asian people supported Trump because they were Vietnamese and they remembered communism. And so when they came to this country, they've always been Republicans because it was the anti-communist party. Like, everybody who comes to their political views has a different story. And so just to say, I think there is a strong strain of young people who feel very self-righteous and say anybody who supports Trump is a racist and bad. And that empowers me to call you the enemy and to say you're victimizing me, when in fact the reality was exactly the opposite.
Hey, this is Julio. And as you probably know by now, I've never gotten my mother's any flowers for Mother's Day. But this week, it's a whole new world for me. 1-800-Flowers is helping me out with a special offer for me and all you In the Thick listeners.
an exclusive 24 for 24 offer. 24 multicolored roses for $24. That's only a dollar per rose. Simply pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. I already put in my orders. They took me no time, and you can do it right now. These breathtaking roses from 1-800-Flowers are picked at their peak and shipped overnight to ensure freshness and mom's amazement. This is an incredible offer, but it expires Friday. To order 24 stunning multicolored roses for only $24, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code ITT. That's 1-800-Flowers.com, code ITT. Hurry up! Offer ends Friday! And once you place that order, tweet me at Julito77, J-U-L-I-T-O, the number 7, and another 7 to show me that you placed it. We children have to stick together. Happy Mother's Day. Feliz Día de las Madres. Hey, and if you're a fan of In the Thick, try our sister podcast, Latino USA. This week, what does it feel like to go from super famous to the new kid on the block? Latino USA hears from people who find themselves in situations they never thought they would be in. Subscribe to Latino USA wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and with me is my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. And we're joined this week by Farrah Stockman, who's a reporter for the New York Times, and Mike German, who's a former FBI agent who went undercover among white supremacists. Let's get right back to our conversation. So the FBI, law enforcement, pretty white. But Mike, you've said that the FBI treats white supremacist groups differently than from like far left groups. So what does that mean? The fact that you've got mostly white law enforcement and that they're looking at, you know, white supremacist groups very differently than they look at the left.
So when I was at the ACLU in 2011, we, through FOIA, obtained a lot of the FBI's counterterrorism training materials.
Wait, whoa, this is getting good already.
So if you look at the demographics within the FBI, it's actually grown wider since 9/11. When I was in the FBI, every year it was getting better as far as its diversity statistics. But after 9/11, it immediately starts trending in the opposite direction to where now it's 83% white, more than 83% white.
Do they care?
They care rhetorically. Every director has said this is an issue that we're very concerned about. I don't think they're actually addressing what are the root causes of it and are trying to, you know, they do more recruiting at historically black colleges and universities and that kind of thing. But it's not a recruiting issue, right? There are a lot of underlying issues to it, and I'm writing about that. But in the training materials, I think it's not that there are, you know, that the FBI is full of racists. It's just, you know, there are some racists, but that's not the bulk of the problem. It's that they know a guy who's racist outside the FBI, you know, somebody who says racist things and has racist beliefs. And they know that person is harmless, right? They're never going to join the Ku Klux Klan. They're not going to go out and cause trouble. They're not going to hurt somebody. And they also know that group that calls itself the Ku Klux Klan, that hangs out at the Waffle House, and you know, they're nasty people who say awful things. And then there are very violent white supremacists that are actually doing harm. And they can distinguish those three things in their mind because they're familiar with them, where when they look at ideologies they aren't familiar with, either communist ideology or socialist ideology or some of this anarchism and what drives Antifa, it's just something they're not familiar with, black bloc. I mean, one of the big things that we see in the materials that I think is a cause of the problem with the excessive law enforcement response is a lot of groups use the term direct action, and it means a lot of things. But basically, it can mean everything from a permitted protest and that kind of thing, all the way to what we talked about before, breaking windows and that kind of thing. But law enforcement interprets direct action as terrorism. And so they ratchet up expecting the worst, and that causes this cycle. But one just easy example is in the materials on white supremacy, there was almost always a caveat that said, you know, most of the activities these groups engage in are First Amendment protected activities that shouldn't be a concern for law enforcement. And that's great. I'm a First Amendment purist. I believe that's great that they put that in there and that that's understood. But they don't have that on the other side. And in fact, there was...
Really? You mean like written when they're dealing with white supremacists, it's like written that this is protected speech, but that's not written when they're talking about like the left?
Not only is it not written, for example, with animal rights extremism, there was a slide that said some of the tactics that environmental rights extremists use and animal rights extremists use are the Freedom of Information Act.
Which is, you know, in their eyes, it's like,
a tactic.
You know.
Right, exactly, where it's this easy linkage of somebody who's interested in doing research on how the FBI is treating animal rights activists all of a sudden becomes a threat. You are actually part of the threat because, you know, I can guarantee you there aren't many terrorists who do FOIA requests to see what the FBI knows about that. You know, please send the materials to my address here, right? It's sort of a silly idea, but this is in FBI training materials sort of promoting this idea that environmental rights and animal rights protest is equal to terrorism.
I interviewed you a couple of years ago, Mike, and you gave an amazing just quick summary of what the threats were considered in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And it seems like, correct me if my memory is wrong, but that in the 70s there were a lot of sort of left-wing violent groups, but that now we've evolved to the 90s, it sort of changed and they were more right-wing.
Well, certainly the way the FBI looked at these groups. I mean, obviously the far right groups, the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist groups were far more deadly in the early part of the century than they were in the later part of the century. You know, that it was just that was sort of, again, state sanctioned, that violence was allowed to occur. So but what we saw, you know, certainly during the 1950s and 60s and 70s, the FBI's concern was with communism and with the influence of communism or socialism on groups that were agitating for social change, whether those were civil rights groups or whether they were anti-war groups. Those sorts of groups were what were the concern. After the COINTELPRO abuses were discovered, there was a little bit less of that. It was less covered. But what we saw is more media attention to right-wing groups. I mean, it's always interesting when I hear researchers talk about the rises in numbers, you know, that the number of white supremacist groups is rising, the number of white nationalists is on the rise. You know, that, okay, do you think that people who are not racist have suddenly become racist? Or do you
think
they're just willing to express it?
What about because who's deadly? How has that changed? Like, which groups are deadliest, I guess? How has that changed over time?
I mean, the violence coming out of the far left since the 1970s is 1980s is really where the last of the Black Liberation Army, whether underground, sort of violence kind of disappeared. There were a lot more terrorist bombings in the United States in the 1970s
exactly.
than there have been over the last 10 years.
Bingo.
By far.
Right.
Huge. Not even close. So, you know, when I talk especially to kids who have grown up post 9/11, college students and whatnot, you know, to say, you know, this feels like we're living in this age of terrorism, but it's actually far reduced from what I grew up with.
And I am going to shout out Latina USA before I ask the final question in this part of the segment. The USA versus Oscar Lopez Rivera talks a lot about the history of these bombings, and actually our producer Marlon Bishop and Maria, they reported the fact that there were so many bombings happening in the 70s from all these extreme far left groups, and people completely have forgotten about that. Mm-hmm. So let's now fast forward to our current time. How big of an issue is this kind of violence right now on the right or on the left? And are you worried that it might escalate further?
I think it's an issue in that it stops. I think it changes the way that people look at the left. I think that there are people in the middle who consider themselves just average, ordinary Americans. Right. They might be persuadable one way or another. And then they see that and they're like, well, you know, if that's what the left is about, then I'm, you know, count me out. A lot of people read my article and had that, you know, wrote to me saying, how can we punish these people? How can we get them off the street? How can we stop them from representing us? And so I think that that's, to the extent that violence always amplifies your message, it's always what people pay attention to, that then they'll become what we talk about instead of policies that advance us forward. That would be my fear.
It's very important to keep perspective in mind. You know, we have this the protest in Washington, D.C., where lots of windows were broken and a limo was torched. And I agree that is violence, and particularly arson is a violent crime that should be treated seriously. But the police rounded up 200 people, including journalists in that roundup. And many of them are charged with felonies. And, you know, I think breaking windows is stupid. I don't think it's helpful to any political cause. But at the same time, you know, I lived through the 1992 riots in L.A. Those were riots. You know, Newark in the 60s, you know, those were riots. You know, that's a very different thing than a few broken windows that are easy to clean up. And what we're seeing, in fact, just the other day, the Washington Times reported on a leaked FBI report that was being characterized as a study that showed violence against police officers, or the rhetoric, anti-police rhetoric, was causing a police stand down. That's not what it said. What it said was they called around to some police who reported that that was true. Not that there was any study that was true, but it's being reported as this situation where the police are seeing themselves as victims or being represented as victims. And that then, again, as we see these cycles, will be used to justify greater police activity, more police violence that will only create more destruction and unrest that will only escalate. And that escalation is what then justifies major crackdowns.
More police.
All right, so let's move on to our final segment, Mic Drop. And this is a segment where guests get to choose from a list of options for their final words. You say your piece, and then you drop the mic.
All right, and we've got five options for you to choose from, Farah and Mike. You can choose from Fantasy CNN, What's Missing, Tough Questions, Mea Culpa, or Side Eye. I love it when I get to be the announcer. And we're going to start with you. Farah, what do you choose?
Oh, I really had a lot of angst about this.
I love when our guests are starting to worry about what to choose for Mic Drop.
We don't want to be a part of your anxiety. We want to relieve it.
I would do a What's Missing, and I think there's just not enough coverage today about why people are angry about globalization, I'll take it back to the economics and say there's just a lot of losers, people who lost in and are not seeing hope for themselves or a place for themselves in the new economy. I'm doing a story about Rex Nord, which is a factory that's moving to Mexico. Trump tweeted about it Sunday night. And all of those, you know, a lot of those factory workers feel special because he's tweeting about them. And so they feel like, oh, my God, there's somebody who really, you know, cares about my economic pain. And that supersedes anything else that Trump is doing with the Treasury Department or with, you know, all the other things. And so I just think in the media, we need to do a better job of really telling the stories of people who are economically left out and how that drives their anger against the elites, their anger against, you know, the other.
What's your mic drop, Mike?
I think I'll stick with the idea of what's missing. And I think, you know, obviously we have had broad coverage of the issue of Russian meddling in the U.S. election. But unfortunately, it's taken this turn where people are just making partisan arguments on each side rather than focusing on what it says overall, right? Either Russian government was meddling in the U.S. election and potentially altered it, or it wasn't. If it was, this is an intelligence failure of immense proportion. We give a $70 billion to build an intelligence community to prevent exactly this. And yet they're not able to prevent that from happening.
What the hell?
It seems shocking. Or they're overstating the evidence, and whatever meddling was involved was not serious any more than pro-Russian radio station sending out pro-Russian messages, in which having the intelligence community have this much influence on the ability of our government to function is incredibly destructive to democracy. And what we need to do is peel the lid off this whole thing, get a lot of the secrecy out of it so we can get straight answers from the intelligence
community. Bravo is all I'm saying. All right, Julio, what's your mic drop?
I'm going with side eye this week. And it has to do with the current governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, who decided to go on Facebook Live on Sunday night to literally sign Senate Bill 4, which is known as in Texas as the Sanctuary Cities Ban Bill. But in fact, if you really look at the bill, it is a cousin of Arizona's State Bill 1070, which the sort of the show me your papers type of bill. And what's interesting, Maria, is that MALDEF, which is one of the original, I call them the original three of the Latino civil rights organizations, have already spoken out against. They're going to be filing several lawsuits about the bill. A lot of Latinos are talking in Texas about this, saying this is just like Arizona. My question is this sort of movement of fighting against these anti-immigrant bills that have become such part of sort of the immigrants' rights movement hitting Texas now? What does it mean for Texas? What's going to happen in Texas in the next couple of years? But, you know, he might be regretting that one down the road in a couple of years, because I'm hearing a lot of resistance already against this bill. Maria, what do you have?
I guess mine would be Fantasy CNN because of what's missing. You see that? I just do.
Maria has a way to take one mic drop and take all of them and put them all together. So it's like, what's missing, mea culpa, on Fantasy CNN? Continue, Maria.
Fantasy CNN would be wall-to-wall coverage about what's happening in Venezuela so that everybody is understanding that on a daily basis, people are putting their lives on the line. The number of journalists who have been assaulted and attacked in Venezuela, so we're not able to get the story straight, is a real problem. And just the masses of people on a daily going out and protesting. And I look at that and I'm like, please don't let that become us.
Uno, dos, tres.
Farrah Stockman, reporter for The New York Times, and Mike German, former FBI agent. Thanks so much for joining Maria and me on In the Thick.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And remember, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. It really, really helps. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell all your friends. Our producer is Noam Hassenfeld. Our senior editor is Nadia Raymond. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire. Some of our music is composed by Noam, and the other music you heard is courtesy of Nacional, Kept, and ZZK Records. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening. Nos vemos.
Because you're at Harvard?
Right near Harvard.
Because you're with your family? Because you're with your people?
Right near my peeps.